Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Stacy Cernick, founder and CEO of Annex Consulting Group, top award-winning entrepreneur, innovating executive, business, and technology authority. Stacy, I know your schedule is just really demanding, so we really appreciate you coming in to do this interview, and you have such a strong history of significant impact in business, industry, technology, educational, societal contributions. So, you know, I know our audience is going to really benefit from your expertise and your insights that, and wisdom that you're going to share during this interview. So thank you again.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you have this incredible history, Stacy. So can you profile your history prior to your current role and three valuable leadership lessons that you wish to share from these roles?
Sure. So I've been with my in my current role as president and CEO of Annex for the last 13 years or so. So that role in terms of running and growing the business keeps me quite busy. In the earlier days of Annex, though, I was a practicing project manager, business analyst, and management consultant. So I've been a project manager since 1992 and received my certification as a PMP, a project management professional, in the year 2000. So those were some of the roles prior to just focusing on the business. Prior to starting Annex, I was a member of the management team at a multinational systems integrator. Back then it was called SHL System House, which became over time EDS and is now HP. So working for them, I was lucky enough to have a few different roles over the years, like programmer analyst, systems analyst. I was a business analyst and a project manager there. And I was even lucky enough to be the HR manager for a while in the Vancouver office, which was a brand new role to me at the time. And I learned a lot about employee recruitment and retention. So I'll share three leadership lessons I've learned and try to sort of give you one from a different role in each case. The first one relates to my time as an HR manager when I was with System House. As a new HR manager, I looking back now, I realize I was spending most of my time dealing with staff issues, which is very common, you know, if you're an HR manager. But the famous 80-20 principle, or Pareto's law, it's sometimes called, it was coming into play in my role, but I actually had it backwards. I was spending 80% of my time on the wrong 20% of the staff. So I was investing a majority of my time in what the management team believed to be the lower performers, trying to help them resolve their issues and maybe, you know, get to a point where they were adding more value for the organization. Looking back on that now, I probably should have spent 80% of my time on the 20% of our staff who were our top performers, because they were the ones who were really the most valuable to the organization. So my leadership lesson number one would be to use the 80-20 principle to look at your business or what you do and really concentrate on the key 20% in your organization, whether that's, you know, the 20% being your top people or your best selling products or even your most profitable customers. My second leadership lesson, I'll take that one from being an entrepreneur running a business. In the famous book, The E-Myth Revisited, by Michael Gerber, he explains that most businesses are started by technicians. So, you know, in our field, in technology, these are people who have a good hard skill, like, say, a programmer or maybe a network specialist. They stop working for someone else and, you know, at some point they decide to go out on their own to do their own thing. My challenge when I started Annex was that I was a pretty good business analyst and a project manager, but I didn't know anything about how to run a business. So over the years, I've had to change my career and really focus on that area. So my leadership lesson there and advice for would-be business owners is to do what I did when I started, which has been really valuable to me, and that's to join a mastermind forum of fellow CEOs. So I've been in one of these mastermind forum groups for about 10 years, and that experience has really taught me how to shift my career from being that hands-on practitioner, the BA and PM, into being a CEO. Finally, my third leadership lesson is more around setting goals. And this is something, goal setting is pretty common and everyone talks about it. I've done it since 1991 when I started at System House, and it sort of applies more to, I guess, all of the roles I've had in my career. It's something I'm really passionate about, and so definitely want to encourage people to do that. And I'll try to illustrate that with a couple of examples. First of all, in order to be successful, you know, as an individual, you got to first figure out or define what success means to you. That's going to be different for everybody. You know, does it mean that you want to achieve a certain amount of financial independence? For some people, it might mean having a great career, or maybe traveling and seeing the world, like my wife, that's her goals. Or maybe having a family and raising children. Other people want to leave a lasting legacy, you know, by making charitable contributions or helping others. It really doesn't matter what you decide. There is no right answer. It's really up to the individual. But I think, number one, it's important to take the time to understand your personal core values and what's important to you, and, you know, think about the future and create a vision of what your ideal life would look like. Once a person does that, once you understand what success means to you, then it's time to set goals. And, you know, as I've mentioned, I'm a big believer in goal setting, also in writing them down. And I have an example that I like to share with respect to writing down goals and goal setting. And people who know me well, they've probably grown tired of hearing this story, but I'm hoping that this story will touch a few new people and they'll get the sense of what I'm talking about here. So Harvard conducted a study. It's a now famous study on all the students in their MBA program more than 30 years ago. So this is around 1979. Each of those MBA students, those graduate students, were interviewed, and they were asked just one very simple question, which was, have you set clear written goals for your future and made plans to accomplish them? So that's what they asked all those MBA grads, and what they found out at the time was that only 3% of the MBA graduates had written goals and plans for accomplishing those goals. So only 3%. 13% of the people they interviewed at the time, those MBA grads, they had goals, but they didn't have them written down. They were sort of bouncing around in their head. And then the rest of them, 84%, had no specific goals at all. So no surprises here. Very few people have, you know, clearly articulated goals, and even fewer write them down. But what they did is 10 years later, so we're now in 1989, the members of the same MBA graduate class were brought back into Harvard and interviewed again, and to sort of see what happened to them and, you know, how they were doing in their career. So the result was pretty surprising to the researchers. So again, remember, with the initial interviews, there were 13% of the graduates who had goals, but they weren't written down. Well, that 13% of the class, they were earning on average twice as much as the 84% of the people who had no goals at all. But remember that 3% of people who had the clear written goals and plans for how to achieve them, they were earning on average 10 times as much as the other 97% of those people combined. So just to say that again to make sure people get it, the 3% of the people, those MBA grads who had written goals and plans to accomplish them, were earning 10 times as much as the combined income of the other 97% of people. So it's a fairly well-known example, and people can Google that and read about it. But my leadership lesson here, my final leadership lesson is, you know, first define what success means to you. Next, define your goals, and remember that it's not enough just to have them in your head. You need to get clear on them. Make sure you write them down, and then last but not least, create an action plan for accomplishing them. And if you do that, I'm quite sure that your life will change.
You know, it's interesting, this idea of you really documenting in a formal way what your goals are, an action plan to complete them. It kind of sort of reminds me of some of the things like you find in that book, The Secret, that was so, you know, widely read, right? So
absolutely, yeah.
Now, you have this amazing company, Annex. Can you profile Annex?
Sure. So Annex is we're an IT consulting and recruitment company. So the company, I created it in 1998, and we serve the Pacific Northwest region of North America, so primarily BC, Alberta, and Washington State. Our consulting services include sort of a couple of different things. So we provide one-person projects or staff augmentations. So in other words, you know, someone needs a project manager for a while to oversee, say, a Windows operating system migration. We do lots of, you know, things like that. But we also have the ability, because we're IT people, we have the ability to outsource team projects. So like, say, a software development initiative where we assemble a team and take the project through from beginning to end. We also have, like recruitment firms, we have a permanent staffing division. So we'll help organizations if they would rather have an employee instead of, you know, temporary contractors to complete an assignment. We'll find employees ranging from CIO to help desk analyst and every role in between. We do a lot of that. Since Annex was created in 1998, we've completed about 1,300 projects over the years for 250 different clients. And one thing I'm proud of is, you know, taking a step back, the IT industry is kind of famous for having troubled projects. Over the years, we haven't done a great job at being successful as an industry. We're getting better, but according to Standish Group, 66% of IT projects fail, and, you know, by either going over schedule or over budget or not meeting the original requirements. But what I'm proud of is across all of the projects Annex has done since 1998, we have a 97% customer satisfaction rating. So that's, we believe, to be the highest in the industry.
That's a pretty amazing rating. And I know that you have a very low turnover rate as well.
Yeah, we do. And you know, one of the things we actually, we joke around with some of our customers is, you know, sometimes it's good if customers ask the companies they're dealing with, like if it's a recruiting company, you know, recruiting companies help customers find people. But a good question to ask those recruiting companies is, you know, what's your turnover? Like, what does your company look like in terms of turnover? And you know, the people that we have in a sales position, we've never lost one of them. Not one of them has left the organization. You know, we have, for sure, terminated people who weren't meeting expectations, a couple of people in the past, but none of our sales team has left voluntarily, so I'm proud of that as well.
Now, I know you have something like over 8,000 IT and business consultants now, and you've been winning all of these awards. So what are your objectives this year, in 2 years and in 5 years?
Well, I guess for this year, our objective is really to, we're thankful to come out of the downturn of 2009 and 2010, like most businesses. Things were, you know, we were lucky enough to stay relatively flat, but we're happy to see the back end of 2009 and 2010. So our objective this year is significant growth. As we emerge from the downturn, we're getting a lot more business. Now we're seeing a lot of companies emerge from their funk or hibernation, when they just didn't have the opportunity to make improvements. So we're hiring a bunch of new staff to accommodate the current growth and the expected growth for the rest of this year. We're also working on, like many businesses, some internal operational improvements to make us better. So automation is part of that, automating processes and just optimizing our processes. We plan to, as well, open a new office in Seattle. So geographic expansion is on the list for this year. And we also are working on introducing at least one new line of business for 2011 that we feel is missing in the marketplace. So, you know, looking ahead a bit more for 2 years down the road, we'll probably, we'll for sure, I believe, expand even further. So more geographic expansion in Western Canada and West Coast U.S. And then some of these market opportunities that we're seeing in terms of new services or lines of business, we're going to be rolling those out as well. And you know, further down the road, say 5 years from now, I see us, again, more geographic expansion, either organically or through acquisition, and then just making sure we're adjusting with the market in terms of, you know, what our customers are expecting or requiring in terms of services and lines of business and business processes.
What's your long-term exit strategy, or do you have one?
I think for many business owners, you know, there are a few options with respect to exit strategy. So, you know, I mean, obviously, number one, you know, I can get to a point where, you know, maybe I decide that it's time to retire and, you know, walk away from the business. I guess everybody has that option to change careers or, you know, finish working. You know, more interesting, I guess, exit strategies for me are to you know, have Annex acquired by a bigger company that may, you know, come and gobble us up as part of its growth strategy. We typically get at least one interested party each year. looking at Annex, but so far we've not gone down that path at all. You know, we could end up maybe grooming someone new to run the business, like an internal manager or, you know, someone like that, someone internally, or bringing someone in to run it, where I, you know, may stay on at maybe a chair level or even, you know, leave the business and have someone take it over. Or I guess there's the option of, as well, maybe the employees decide to take it on themselves. Those are sort of some of the things that we talk about and think about.
Now, you have this ability to really examine your 8,000 independent consultants and IT experts who are really, you know, 97% customer satisfaction. That just blows my mind. So you're in a perfect position to kind of detail what the attributes make for success. And I have a series of questions around this. So what are the attributes that make for a successful developer?
That's a good question. You know, we have thousands of developers in our group, and we've worked with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them over the years. So I think, you know, number one, obviously, a great developer needs solid technical skills, a technical aptitude at what they do, you know, whether they're a .NET developer, a Java developer, or a LAMP stack developer. You know, we have people who work in all platforms and all databases, using all development tools. So a solid technical aptitude is sort of a must-have, of course. I think with our industry, you know, with technology, the second attribute would be lifelong learning. You know, we just definitely enjoy working with people who are adaptable and willing to learn. Technology changes so quickly that there's the ongoing constant requirement to learn new tools and techniques. I would say problem solving is another key attribute for great developers. So problem solving to me also includes creativity, like how are we going to solve this issue or create a solution. Attention to detail is another big one. So you know, when you're dealing in the world of parentheses and very defined syntax, a developer needs to be able to operate at a low level of detail and to handle all, cases in terms of testing and quality, et cetera. And finally, I think, when I look at our developers, the ones who are very successful are often the ones who are also very strong communicators. So with those skills, they're able to really understand a client's needs and turn that those needs or those requirements into a solution.
Okay, so continuing with this sort of series of questions, then, what makes for a successful project manager?
So definitely communication. I used to joke around in presentations that 95% of project management is communication and 5% is prayer. So communication is really, you know, it's by far the number one. So verbal and written communication, listening, facilitation. Much of project management is communication. And another thing I've said a lot in the past in terms of presentations I've done to project manager audiences is, you know, looking at some of the programs that I'm involved in terms of project management, we're seeing a lot more women enter the field of project management. And in fact, in some of the programs that I advise, that percentage is very often over 50%. And, you know, women are great communicators. And so I think that in many cases, they naturally are great project managers, given that, to me anyway, the number one attribute is communication. Number two for me is leadership skills. So, you know, as a project manager, we need to understand when to use what leadership style. So the leadership styles will change depending on, you know, the task at hand and the person doing that task, you know, what their competency level is with that task and their motivation to complete the task. So that's all important. Number three for me would be experience. You know, I mentioned that 66% of IT projects fail. Great project managers, they've learned those lessons from past failures, and so now they know how to make projects successful. We really enjoy working with those people who have, you know, they have those battle scars and they've learned those lessons. A big one as well is planning skills. Research, I've done research in, you know, why projects fail, and much of that research points to poor planning. So, you know, projects are often doomed before they even begin because, you know, they haven't been planned well or estimated well. So that's a key skill. And finally, I would say sort of the combination of problem solving and decision making as well. I've presented a number of times in the past on my top characteristics of successful project managers. And so if you just kind of take a look at the list I just gave you, so communication, leadership, experience, planning, and problem solving, there's three out of those five are soft skills. two, the experience part and the planning skills part are hard skills. There's actually been quite a bit of research done in this area, and the research says that approximately two-thirds of the skills of a great project manager are soft skills. Yet, if you look at, say, the project management body of knowledge by PMI, a very well-known project management guidelines methodology, 7 of the 9 knowledge areas in the PMBOK are hard skills. So, you know, my advice to PMs out there is, don't underestimate the value and importance of soft skills. And in fact, I would recommend focusing training programs in those areas.
It's interesting that you bring up the soft skills. You know, I've done, 600-700 interviews, something like that, over the last 10 years, and it's a common theme that comes up worldwide. Now, what attributes make for a successful business analyst?
So there will be some overlap here with some of the others that we've talked about, but for sure, I think, you know, business analysis, like project management, the key is communication. So verbal and written communication, you know, listening to customers to understand their requirements, facilitation, of workshops, interviewing skills, all that is critically important for a great BA. Analytical thinking as well. So that's something that's, maybe a bit different from some of the other ones, but it's called business analysis, and really an analytical thinking is really important. So that's, by that I mean problem solving. I mean it's sort of a general level of intelligence, a comprehension of challenges, issues, solutions, being curious and objective, in looking at solutions, and as well having, imagination and creativity in coming up with those solutions. Interpersonal skills are key, building rapport and relationships, because BAs often are relationship managers with business units. So someone who's friendly and professional and has good emotional intelligence, to me, is really important. Industry knowledge as well. So BAs, successful BAs tend to have really strong business domain expertise. So as an example, in 2008, here at Annex, we had a huge demand for healthcare business analysts. And now, we're seeing that demand here in early 2011. We're seeing that demand for more around financial services and the insurance industry. So having great business acumen and industry expertise is great. And then finally, I'd just say, attitude, the get things done attitude, hardworking, persistent, the positive, happy, enthusiastic person. Those are great qualities of a successful BA.
What attributes make for a successful management consultant?
Management consulting. So communication, again, for sure. All the same stuff that I mentioned about, verbal and written, the listening, the facilitation. I think, as a management consultant, though, one that's different is maybe, being that big picture thinker and being strategic in nature. I think that's important. Leadership skills are important as well for a management consulting professional, as well as interpersonal skills, to build those relationships and emotional intelligence, being professional and diplomatic. And I would also say someone who just has deep business experience, most successful management consultants, they have to be an expert in one area of business. And so, our consultants, when they hire management, our clients, when they hire management consultants, they're looking for someone who has been there, done that, with deep industry expertise and a lot of lessons to share.
Let's now extend that to the attributes that make a successful infrastructure professional.
Sure. So like a developer, I think an infrastructure professional needs a strong technical aptitude in those networking and infrastructure technologies. Lifelong learning, again, becomes key here because these technologies are changing constantly and require ongoing education and certification. Problem solving is also big here with infrastructure people. So whether it relates to, design, like optimizing network architecture, or whether it's figuring out, where a production problem is occurring, I think that's important. The successful infrastructure people we deal with are very detail-oriented, so, ensuring that all the I's are dotted and, T's crossed, the patches are in place, the system works after a migration, there's, permissions are set up, operability tests are done, those kinds of things. And finally, I would say as well, it's pretty important for infrastructure professionals to have integrity because, these folks often have access to critical company information like HR data or financial data or legal data. So they need to be someone that you can trust.
So we've covered quite a number of roles. Are there others that you can think of in terms of computing and some attributes that make for success, again, based on your experiences at Annex?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, we deal with a lot of different roles within within IT. You know, like database people, technical architects, technical writers, trainers. There's many other roles, but you know, I think there's some common themes around, you know, what attributes are key for success. So communication skills, you've heard me talk about that. It's come up many times. That's very important, especially if you're, you know, if you're a consultant, like the people we deal with to do our projects, you know, you're only as good as your last project. And very often starting a new project as a consultant is like starting a new job. technical aptitude, of course, you know, in the relevant technology area is important. Lifelong learning has come up a lot. I think, you know, it's just the nature of our industry that people need to be adaptable and ready for change. I love people with great attitudes. You know, I mean, at Annex, we hire sometimes purely based on attitude, you know, positive, happy, high energy people with a get it done mentality. And of course, the interpersonal skills to build relationships and you know, strong emotional intelligence, being compatible is those are very much, you know, maybe 4 out of 5 are soft skills. But I think, you know, what we say at Annex is your hard skills will get you your first contract with the client. You know, someone who's a great developer will get noticed. Their resume speaks for itself. But it's really the soft skills that will get that person repeat business.
Now, in your current role, what are the top challenges and top opportunities?
Top challenges. I would say the number one challenge that I see coming up here is going to be the availability of talented people to do project work. So the market's improving. We're seeing the economy here locally where we are in Western Canada really pick up, and we're starting to see a supply problem for talented technology professionals. So as an example, the number one requirement from our clients over the past 6 months has been for business analysts, and it's becoming quite difficult now to in our local office here in Vancouver to find good BAs who are not already busy. So I see that that availability issues sort of moving to other skill types as well within IT. That's coming. Number two, this one's more around running a small and growing business. One of our challenges is to raise awareness of our services, do marketing on a, you know, a tight budget. We're not big enough to bring in a full-on marketing team, you know, to run a whole, you know, strategic marketing program. So, you know, most relatively small businesses don't have the luxury of having a marketing department. So one of the things that we do to raise awareness is we have a referral program, and this is something that has worked very well for us. So it's been featured in many, you know, magazines, papers, in a book, publications. It's wildly successful for us, and it encourages people to refer, you know, business and consultants to us. 95% of the work we do is either referred or it's repeat business from an original referral. So the program works very well. And so I'd encourage businesses to look at a referral program. And also in terms of marketing, we're using social media to, you know, build our network of connections and followers and try to add value to those people to help us get the word out about Annex. So people can follow us at our Twitter account is Annex Group. A third challenge for us is just, you know, managing growth. I mentioned earlier that the market is up. So at Annex, our monthly revenues are up 50% right now year over year for the last quarter. And so it's just sort of keeping up with that pace is becoming a challenge. So finding the right internal staff to grow the company and then ensuring that our systems and processes are scalable to accommodate that future growth. So we've been working for the last while to strengthen the foundation so that we can, you know, build a bigger house. In terms of opportunities, I think the most obvious opportunity right now is just the economic recovery as companies have emerged from the downturn. We're excited to be able to help more clients and more consultants. So that's a great opportunity for all of us. For Annex, we have another great opportunity in terms of expanding. So to new geographic markets. So we're in a place now, I think, you know, by taking advantage of that downturn over the last couple of years and working on our internal efficiencies and processes, we're in a place to take that footprint and expand it to other office locations. So we're planning to do that. And then I mentioned earlier as well, some of the new lines of businesses that we're working on, we really see a number of areas in the market that I think are being underserved. And I recommend that people read the book, Blue Ocean Strategy. It's by Chan Kim and Renee Malborn. And what they say in the book is that a blue ocean opportunity means a market that, you know, there's no competitors there. It's poised. It's a market that's poised for growth and doesn't have competitors. So that's opposed to what they refer to as a bloody red ocean, where there are many competitors in a market, and which results in shrinking profits. So we feel that we have a couple of blue ocean opportunities here at Annex, and we're working on rolling those out. So we see that as a great opportunity for the future as well.
With your speaking engagements, all the different kinds of connections you're in, and relationships you're involved with, like, for example, you indicated you're part of a CEO group, and you have this amazing base of professionals that you're working with, and you also advised universities because of your expertise in the field and more generally. I'm thinking that you're perfectly positioned to make some forecasts. So can you give your ideas of what you see as the trends this year and next?
Sure. The trend for jobs. In 2011, I mean, we're way up compared to 2010. And, you know, as I mentioned, business for us is up 50% in the last 3 months compared to the same quarter last year. So I think it's great. At least here in Western Canada, I think the prospects are great for jobs. As we look forward, you know, a bit longer term into 2012 and beyond, we may not see growth as high as what we're experiencing, you know, emerging from a down economy. But I do think that the activity level will stay pretty steady over, say, 2012 and hopefully beyond. So there's an industry watchdog in Canada called ICTC, Information and Communications Technology Council. So they monitor the Canadian IT industry, and they've recently come out with a labor market report very recently in the last couple of months. So they're predicting that here in Canada, Canadian employers are going to need to hire an additional 106,000 ICT workers, so information and communications technology workers, between 2011 and 2016. So, you know, that's a lot of people, a lot of extra people that, as an industry, we need to hire across the country. So I think the trend for the next 5 years is that job prospects will be good for IT workers, and there will even be, you know, in some cases, for some key skills, there's going to be significant shortages.
Yeah, let's delve into that a little bit more detail. So sometimes when people hear these stats about a labor shortage, they just think the overall field, but really it's a skill shortage, isn't it, in specific areas?
Yeah, it can be both labor and skill. So it depends on I mean, we have an overall labor shortage. You know, 106,000 people for sure is a labor shortage within IT. But within that 106,000, you know, if we slice and dice that down and take a look at what are some of the key skills, there will definitely be some, you know, certain areas that will be more in demand than others. And what is in demand will change over time. So, you know, for example, I mentioned that BAs right now are in demand. And in fact, as we emerge from this, you know, this downturn we've experienced, any IT professional that works at, say, the front end of projects, like a business analyst or a management consultant or a project manager initiating projects, we're seeing heavy demand for those people. Over time, as those projects get kicked off and initiated and, you know, approved, the downstream effect will be the demand for the more hands-on technical folks like developers and infrastructure professionals. So we see that happening now, that trend is starting now.
For those who are currently students, if are recent graduates, which areas should they focus on?
For recent graduates, I think, you know, they definitely need to focus on technical competency in the areas that interest them the most. You know, coming out of school, these young people have the opportunity to sort of take a look at areas that they like and maybe concentrate there. But I also think, you know, they have to look there's a strong chance they're going to change careers in the future. So I think it's important to do what you like. And what I mean by that in terms of changing careers is, you know, if you look at, say, my parents' generation, the baby boomers, you know, the baby boomers typically had, they had only maybe one or two career changes in their lives. You know, if you think of your parents or your parents' friends, many of them worked at the same job for, you know, in lots of cases, their entire career. The next generation of people, you know, people of my generation, they're probably going to have, you know, research shows they're going to have maybe three or four career changes in their lifetimes. But if you, you know, go online and do some research about today's new graduates, you know, those young people coming out of school today, you know, some of the research that I've looked at are saying, or is saying that these young people graduating today are going to have 10 to 12 career changes in their lifetime. So, I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot of change. So what's important for the new grads, I think, is do what you really like to do, because chances are you may change later anyway, so you might as well have fun now. But also, you know, take this advice, and, you know, if understand that if there's going to be multiple career changes in your future, then build general skills that can be used in different careers. So, you know, people need to be open to change and they need to be adaptable and build some of those general skills, like soft skills, that will help them regardless of what career they choose.
This has been covered throughout this interview, but perhaps you can summarize again for experienced IT professionals, which areas should they focus on from a career or job standpoint?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I talked about baby boomers, and you know, those folks are starting to retire. My dad was born in 1945, so he's kind of like the oldest of the baby boomers. And, you know, those folks are starting to leave the workforce. And, you know, based on the demand I mentioned, those 106,000 people in Canada required over the next 5 years, there just aren't enough new people going through our school system to make up for, you know, not only that demand, but also those baby boomers who are leaving the workforce. So I think younger workers are going to get management opportunities earlier than maybe the baby boomers did. So these experienced IT professionals who may be at, you know, intermediate levels or maybe even senior levels, they may want to focus as well on general management skills to progress their careers, because I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity in leadership as these more senior people leave the industry. So, you know, general management skills like leadership, communications, negotiation, conflict resolution, those are the kinds of things I think those people should maybe focus on, even industry specialization.
What are your current projects, and what one lesson can you share from each of your major projects?
Yes, current projects. We have hundreds, but I'll try to grab a couple here. So I guess one I'll look at is a software development team project. We're doing a web-based registration system, and you know, despite the fact that we have 97% client satisfaction, you know, this was a project that initially was in trouble, and we had to go in and rescue it. And the lesson I can share from that is that it's important to have a dedicated project manager on a team software development project. So what started off for us as a very small development project where we didn't think we needed a dedicated PM blossomed from 12 weeks into 9 months due to scope creep and, you know, the client wanting to make their system even better. And so partway through that, we realized that, you know, this is going to be bigger than expected, and we needed to get a PM in there and, you know, just manage the scope. And it's just project management 101, but, you know, it's always good for us to go through that and be reminded that we need a PM on our projects, no matter how small. Project number two is actually more a series of engagements that we're doing for a large organization. It's a multi-billion-dollar organization. They're going through a very large-scale business transformation program worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So we, as an organization, we have a fairly large team of people working with this client, and those people are working on a whole different variety of IT roles. The challenge here is that the staff of the client organization, they've been using legacy systems for the last 25 years, and in doing so, they've done things the same way for a long time. So, you know, I see this over and over again. If we do ERP projects or, you know, just rolling out technology, enterprise technology in general, is that the challenge of replacing legacy systems or rolling out technology, it's not the technology. Much of technology these days, it's off the shelf and it's proven. You know, the technology generally works. The challenge is really on the people side. It's the change management component of a project and getting, you know, the company's staff and employees to adapt to these new ways of doing things. And this can be especially difficult in the context of, you know, trying to improve employee engagement, which is a very common metric across organizations these days. So I just, you know, want to remind people, it may seem obvious to some, but, you know, change management is key. Don't forget about it in large-scale technology projects.
And looking over your background, you're involved with many major associations, societies, and so on. So why would you recommend people get involved, for example, PMI?
PMI. So Project Management Institute, there's a few reasons to be involved. So, I've been a member of PMI for many, many years, and it's the largest and most recognized project management association in the world. So, right there, it's a great opportunity to collaborate with others, with more than 500,000 members around the world. PMI also, they manage the PMP certification, the Project Management Professional. So that's the most recognized project management certification globally. And there are, I don't remember the number of PMs, but it's about 500,000 half a million project manage or certified project managers in the world. But these certified PMs exist in 185 countries worldwide. So I think many project managers these days are getting certified, and so that's another great reason to be involved with PMI. The PMBOK, the Project Management Body of Knowledge, it's the most widely used PM practices in the world, so it's good exposure, to that book or that guideline. For me personally, all that is great stuff, but I like being involved in these associations because, there's a networking component with like-minded peers where you can share your experiences and, collaborate and raise your personal profile. And of course, there's educational benefits as well when, you can hear speakers, talk at events or learn from, other people like yourself.
Why would you recommend people get involved with KIPS, the Canadian Information Processing Society?
I've been involved with KIPS for many, many years as well. And, one thing I like about KIPS is, or a great reason to get involved is KIPS is helping to promote professionalism within the computing industry in Canada. So, I think that's a great reason to be involved. KIPS has industry certifications as well, the ISP and ITCP designation. So, like PMI, there's a certification that, maybe will help an individual raise their personal profile or stand above others. Again, for me, the big benefit or what I liked about being involved with KIPS is the networking with peers and seeing others in the industry and catching up with them and, sharing experiences. There's always an education and learning component to associations, which is valuable. And for me, I not only was involved with KIPS as a member, but I was, on the board for many years. And so for me, the other reason I got involved was just to, give back to our local IT community, which was important for me.
You have a number of advisory roles that you perform and have. And so what are the benefits of some of these advisory roles?
So benefits of those roles, for me, again, a lot of it's around just giving back to the industry that's been so good to me. So I'm a member of the advisory council at the University of British Columbia for their certificate in project management program. So I've been there as an advisor since the program was created in 2002. So I really enjoy being involved to give back. But I also like being involved because I get to help shape how project management and project managers of the future, how the training is being done and how they're being educated based on, my experience hiring project managers for our client organizations. So I've mentioned many times, today in this interview about the importance of soft skills. So, being involved in the program allows me to emphasize how important soft skills are and to make sure that the curriculum includes those opportunities, to make project managers more successful. I'm also involved as an advisor for UBC Certificate in Business Analysis. So, benefits there are, I get to be involved to ensure that this new program at UBC conforms to industry standards in business analysis. So, the IIBA, the International Institute of Business Analysis, and their BA body of knowledge, making sure the program is aligned with that, because I think that's going to be important for the future. And then, meeting new people and giving back is important to me, as I mentioned. I'm an advisor to small businesses as well, quite a few small businesses. So that is, to me, it's great. I really enjoy it because I feel I can, based on my experience, I can accelerate entrepreneurs and their businesses, based on all the lessons I learned the hard way going through the trenches. And I'm also a career advisor to a number of computing students at local universities and colleges. And, it gives me, again, pleasure to be involved and help shape someone's life, and hopefully I can add value to them And I try to go out and do presentations at elementary schools, high schools, colleges, and universities to encourage young people to consider careers in technology.
Now, you're a mentor for something called Success. Can you tell me what that involves?
Yeah, Success is a not-for-profit organization that helps. They have a whole variety of services, but one of the areas that I'm involved in is Success helps new immigrants adapt to life in Canada. Canada is a fantastic country because of our, multiculturalism. It's very cosmopolitan, especially here in Vancouver. It's what I love about living here. And so I am involved with Success because I have the opportunity to help people who are new to the country sort of adapt to life here. And so I do it, part of my personal giving back philosophy, just to give back is great. But, I meet a lot of new people and where I can add value to these folks is Success knows that, my expertise is in technology. So what they'll often do is assign me new Canadians who have technology backgrounds, and then I can help to mentor them and get them up to speed on what Canadian companies are looking for, and maybe help them find their next job to help fill that supply gap with some of the new immigrants, very talented new immigrants who are coming to Canada.
You have a company that has won innumerable awards for many, many years as one of the top companies in the country as a provider of solutions to many, many industries. So from that position, can you make some predictions from a technological standpoint of where things are going, their implications, and how we can best prepare?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. My expertise or my focus is really around IT consulting, so I'll try to make some predictions around that area because that's where I think, I have the most knowledge. My first prediction is that the supply shortage of IT professionals in Canada will continue in the future, and more likely than not, it's going to get worse. So again, referencing that the more than 100,000 people that we need to hire in the next 5 years, with the baby boomers leaving the workforce I mentioned, there's just not enough supply of newcomers to the industry. We're not putting enough people through computing programs across the country to make up for that demand. So I think that's something we're going to have to deal with. Immigration is definitely one way to do that, but I do think we need to bring more young people through technology, through our schooling system. My second prediction is that consulting in general, the consulting industry is going to continue to flourish. When I first started Annex, there were quite a few companies, clients that I would talk to or prospects who didn't hire consultants at all. They just dealt with employees internally. Things have changed over the last 10, 12, 14 years. There are a lot more consultants providing a lot more services to a lot more organizations. So it's become accepted that, most large organizations have a mixed model in terms of staffing. They have their employees and they also bring in outside experts as required. So I think, the baby boomers leaving the workforce, not all of them are going to retire. Some of them are going to want to do consulting for part-time fun or to stay busy. We know that, if you look down at the next generation of workers, the Generation X and Y workers, after the baby boomers, they like their quality of life. That's well documented. Consulting provides those people with the opportunity to be their own boss and set their own hours and, do the work that they want to do while being very flexible. So 97% of businesses in Canada are small businesses, and of those, more than 80% have 10 or fewer employees. So I think, small business and particularly this idea of freelance consulting, it's not just a trend, but it's an economic powerhouse in our country. It drives a lot of the economy and jobs. So how do we prepare for these predictions? I mentioned we need, we somehow need to fill that gap for people leaving the workforce and just the general demand. So I encourage people out there, if you're listening to this, if you're in the IT industry, try to do what I've tried to do in the past. Go out and speak to young people and encourage those young people to consider careers in technology. I think this is especially important for young women because women represent only about 25% of the IT workforce in Canada. So, I think we need more women in technology. So if people could do that, I think that would really help not only our industry, but also help Canada to be more globally competitive as well.
There's this upcoming IFIP, World CIO Forum, or WCF, and In your opinion, why should IT executives attend this interesting and sort of unique event?
Yeah, this is a cool event. There are associations for CIOs in various countries. Like in Canada, we have CIOCAN, and there are a few chapters, in a number of Canadian cities. But it's rare to have a world CIO conference. So, reasons to attend, in my opinion, what a great opportunity to meet IT leaders from around the world, where, we may not otherwise get that chance. Obviously, this is a great way to increase collaboration between these IT leaders, these CIOs. Things like best practices or lessons learned, or new ideas. Just that collective knowledge is fantastic. There's for sure an educational and learning component to hearing the speakers and understanding what others are doing in other countries, how they've resolved some of their challenges. And it's also just an opportunity to network and raise your personal profile, which is something I'm a real big believer in, and why, I belong to many associations, to get out there and, get yourself known and raise your profile, and it'll help your career.
You also talked about the work of KIPPS here in this country, but also the sort of general idea of professionalism. So what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession, like medicine and law or engineering, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, and recognized credentials?
Yeah, we, as an industry, computing, we still have some work to do to get to that point, but I think we're definitely making progress. So as an example, you mentioned medicine as a recognized profession. Medicine's obviously a complex field. There's many different areas of medicine, like, say cardiology, nursing, general practitioners like family doctors, pediatrics, et cetera. There's lots of different areas of medicine, and it's obviously an important profession for our society. I think computing should be recognized as a profession. So first of all, I think computing is also, like medicine, is also important for society. Granted, computing or technology may not be life and death in some cases like medicine, but if you think about it, much of healthcare relies on technology. So the argument maybe can be made that technology is sometimes a matter of life and death, because it really keeps our medical systems running. Outside of healthcare, if you look at businesses in general, they depend on technology every day. Technology is critical to every large business, so it's very important for our global economy. And even if you extend, the importance of technology to the personal side of things, technology is everywhere. So there are 640 million Facebook users worldwide, including my two teenage kids. There are 200 million Twitter users worldwide. There's 100 million LinkedIn users. So we're, as a society, we're reliant on technology in all of these different areas, healthcare, business, personal, et cetera. So if we're so reliant on that technology, then we're also relying on the competency and the professionalism of the people who create and manage that technology. So that's why we need a recognized governing body, and a certification for computing with a code of ethics, the body of knowledge. It's challenging because, each country may have, different ways of doing things. So, and like medicine, IT has many different practice areas. So, we have software development, we have application support and commercial software implementation, all the networking and infrastructure specialists out there, security, so like medicine, there are many different areas. But the IP3, stands for the International Professional Practice Partnership. So, that's a mouthful. That's why they call it IP3. They're taking a leadership role to help foster professionalism in the IT industry worldwide. So, as you might imagine, that's a huge job. We have to create a common language so that everyone can communicate. We have to define standard roles across the industry and across countries. And that, that's a challenge. We have to determine how to measure quality, in what we do as an industry. But the work's in progress, which is great, and I'm quite sure we're going to get there. It's going to require a lot of collaboration, but the good news is that I think we're going to get there, and work is well underway.
We're down to our last question, and I'm turning the tables in that. If you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
That's a great question. I think I'd probably ask questions that maybe would help the people who are listening to the interview maybe get to know the person on the other end better, so that they're, more than just a talking head. So the questions that I might ask are maybe more general about life and success, and that maybe will help to attract an audience outside of, you know, people who are interested in technology as well. So for my first question, I might ask something like, you know, in order to get to know you better, can you share some of your life goals and what's on your bucket list? To answer that question, I'll give you three of my life goals on my list, just so people maybe can get to know me better. Number one relates to being a dad. So one of my most important life goals is that I like to raise my two kids to be happy, healthy, and nice. So those are the big three things that I always say to them. I say it when they were young, and I, you know, tucked them into bed every night. I would say to them, you know, all I care about when you grow up is I want you to be happy, healthy, and a nice person. You know, since then I've added, I want them to be confident that they can do anything they desire, but, you know, that's important to me. It's not maybe easy to measure, but that's definitely a life goal for me. Number two is more sort of closer to the business side of things. I like to grow Annex to a size that allows me to achieve my personal goals. And I guess number three, one of those goals or one of those dreams I have is to create the Annex Foundation. And what I'd like to do sort of later on in life is operate that foundation, which will exist to help people achieve their dreams. So some people are not as fortunate. You know, I've been very lucky in my life to do a lot of the things that I love, and I would love to be able to help other people do the same. So I've done a little bit of that in my life, and I can tell you it's very addictive to help people achieve their dreams and to give back in that way and to participate. And you know, I think we're put on this earth to serve others. So, you know, that's one of my main life goals, helping people achieve their dreams. Question number two, question I'd ask is to maybe help to people, you know, listening to understand me better or to get to know me better. What five people, living or not, would you invite for dinner? So I would invite Winston Churchill to talk about leadership. I'd invite Nelson Mandela to talk about perspective. I'd invite Mother Teresa to talk about compassion. I'd invite Tony Robbins to talk about motivation. And I'd probably invite someone like Robin Williams to make us all laugh. And then my third question that I would ask people is, you know, what three books would you recommend? You know, I've mentioned throughout this interview that I'm a big fan, a big advocate of lifelong learning. So I do a lot of reading. I'm an avid reader, and people can email me if they want, and I'd be happy to send them my list of top 100 books that I'd recommend. But, you know, if someone asked me what three books would you recommend, I've read so many great ones that I'd probably just, for this interview, I'd focus on books that concentrate on sort of success and making people successful and achieving their dreams. So number one, I'd recommend a book called The Success Principles by Jack Canfield. It's a big, thick book, but it has everything in there on, you know, how to live a great life. I'd recommend a book called Having It All by John Assaraf, who you mentioned, Stephen, earlier about The Secret. He was actually part of the book in the movie. That's a great book, especially for people who are maybe new to goal setting and wanting to get some advice on, you know, how to go about doing that. And finally, I'd recommend a book called Focal Point by Brian Tracy. I think if people were to read those books, they may see some overlap, but if they follow the advice in those three books, I'm quite sure they're going to improve their life.
You know, those are amazing questions. They're better than mine.
Well, maybe I'll interview you next time.
Well, you know, Stace, I really enjoyed you coming in today and sharing your insights and about things about you personally, which we don't often talk about in these interviews. So really, really, you know, it's been a great time here, and I know your schedule is demanding, and I know our audience is really fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom and insights with the audience.
My pleasure, Stephen. I really want to thank you again for having me. It's been great. Thanks.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Stacey Cernik, founder and CEO of Annex Consulting Group, top award-winning entrepreneur, innovating executive, business and technology authority.